The third case of this morning is number 023703, Heather J. Austin against the Caterpillar Company. Mr. Bennett.
Thank you, Judge. May it please the Court, my name is Jason Bennett. I'm an associate with Bennett, Benning & Clary in Lafayette, Indiana. My firm represents Heather Austin, the appellant in this case. We are before the Court on appeal from the District Court's grant of summary judgment in favor of Caterpillar, which was Ms. Austin's former employer. It's a Title VII case involving retaliatory discharge. There are two fundamental issues on this appeal. The first one, whether Ms. Austin was able to satisfy the first prong, and then we also focused on the third prong of the McDonnell-Douglas indirect method of proof for a discrimination claim. The second issue being whether Ms. Austin presented sufficient evidence from which a reasonable jury could conclude that Caterpillar failed to take reasonable efforts to enforce its on-paper anti-discrimination policy, and therefore whether it could be held liable in punitive damages. As to the first prong of McDonnell-Douglas, this Court relatively recently decided Stone v. City of Indianapolis, which set out a new rule for establishing a prima facie case. It's a four-prong test. The first one, whether the complainant made a protected expression, which is undisputed in this case. Ms. Austin made two complaints about racial animus in the workplace, specifically geared towards biracial children, such as her own son, and one fellow employee's use of the N-word, which he believed to be targeted at her. The second prong being whether she suffered an adverse employment action, which is also undisputed. She did, in fact, lose her job. Caterpillar terminated her. The remaining two prongs of her prima facie case are whether she was performing her job satisfactorily and whether there were similarly situated non-complaining employees who were treated better than Ms. Austin was. Those were where we focused most of our attention in both our briefings to this court and to an extent to the trial court. We believe that as to whether Ms. Austin's performance was satisfactory, that there's direct record evidence from which a rational jury could conclude that her performance was in fact satisfactory, that evidence at least being sufficient for purposes of her prima facie case, if not necessarily in the context of pretext. And also, we believe that there are perfectly reasonable inferences from designated record evidence to support an inference that similarly situated non-complaining employees were treated better than she was. That being the case, the burden would shift back to Caterpillar to set forward a facially legitimate, non-discriminatory reason for terminating Ms. Austin, at which point the burden would shift back to Ms. Austin to demonstrate pretext. And we don't dispute that for purposes of the second McDonnell-Douglas prong, Caterpillar has done so. And so we focus the remaining portion of our arguments on the pretext issue. An employee can raise a genuine issue of material fact on pretext by casting doubt on either the truthfulness or the sufficiency of her employer's reasons advanced for terminating her. In this case, we believe that we've presented sufficient record evidence that Caterpillar's proffered reasons were insufficient to justify that termination. If I can go back to the first prong of McDonnell-Douglas, Ms. Austin's prima facie case, go into a little bit greater detail. Whether Ms. Austin's performance was satisfactory, this court has specifically held, can, for purposes of her prima facie case, be supported by her own testimony, and that's what we have in this case. At page 22 of our appendix before this court, Ms. Austin testifies in her deposition, quote, "I would just go over and ask Jeremy if he needed me to move anything. I usually had an hour left to go and help someone else. I would usually go and see if anybody needed help," end quote. That evidence is sufficient. It is directly on point, and it is sufficient for purposes of making out her prima facie case. The final question under her prima facie case, then, is whether there were similarly situated, non-complaining employees who were treated better. In this case, we have two depositions, one being of Rick North, the other of Dennis Mitchell. Both of those gentlemen had worked for nearly 20 years at Caterpillar, nearly 40 years of total experience between the two of them. Both of them testified that in all that time, neither of them had ever heard of any employee being terminated for the reasons the Caterpillar
events
in this
case. Are either of those gentlemen supervisors?
They are not, Your Honor, but it's clear from their depositions that they were in a position to see whether the performance of a distribution technician like Ms. Austin was sufficient.
Did you take any discovery with respect to Caterpillar's disciplinary policy with respect to other employees on this matter? How they had treated other employees?
Not beyond these two depositions, Your Honor. We believe that they were
available to you, but you certainly could have engaged in discovery and found out exactly how Caterpillar treats situations like this, right?
That's what we were aiming to do by talking with these two long-tenured employees. The particular reason that we wanted to get Mr. North's testimony is that it was, in fact, his emails noting to Caterpillar management that he believed that Ms. Austin was having some problems with overstocking or understocking certain areas that were within her responsibility. Since he was in a position to report those, we believe that he was certainly in a position to have found, in the course of his extensive experience at Caterpillar, to have a feel for the way that complaints like this typically were resolved. Essentially, working under the theory that a brick is not a wall, a brick is not required to be a wall, that this would be sufficient for a reasonable juror to infer what Caterpillar's previous treatment of similarly situated employees had been. Both of those gentlemen testified both that other distribution technicians in the past, that was Ms. Austin's position, distribution technician, had had stocking problems, both understocking and overstocking, and that was one of the two reasons the Caterpillar advanced for her termination. The other reason was something the Caterpillar called teamwork problems, which here Mr. Mitchell testified specifically that in his previous experience at Caterpillar, again that was about 19 years worth, that in his experience if there were problems with people getting along with their team, the Caterpillar would move those employees to other teams, not terminating the employee, kicking them out of the Caterpillar league entirely.
Did he specifically address whether that was the way Caterpillar handled situations with probationary employees?
He did not specifically address that, but we believe that's a reasonable inference from his testimony that over that length of time that some of these employees that he was referencing, we think it can reasonably be inferred, were probationary. That would particularly be the case because this court does review the grant of summary judgment de novo, and it has specifically held that that de novo standard is, quote, applied with added rigor in employment discrimination cases where intent is inevitably the central issue, close quote. Since we believe that Ms. Austin completed her prima facie case, as I mentioned, the burden shifts back to Caterpillar. We concede that Caterpillar met its burden under the second prong of McDonnell Douglas. So the burden shifts back to us to show that Caterpillar's reasons for firing her were pretextual. By, for example, showing those reasons to be insufficient to justify termination. And again, we believe that's where the deposition testimony of those two gentlemen comes back in, that in their previous experience they had seen these kinds of problems before in people who held Ms. Austin's position, and that they had not been terminated for that reason, that at least Mr. Mitchell had seen other employees in Ms. Austin's situation who had teamwork problems, and that they had not been terminated for those reasons either. We believe that further evidence of pretext can be found in the fact that during Ms. Austin's 30-day performance review on September 18, 2000, which was a Monday, Caterpillar was obviously taking a coaching-type approach to her. They complimented her on having learned several new tasks, several new responsibilities. They did mention that there were a few other areas that she should work on, but the tenor of that performance review did not suggest that these were problems that had her skating on thin ice, so to speak. They were just simply part of her ongoing development as an employee. Suddenly, on September 25th, which was the day she was fired, that was the following Friday, or the following Monday, rather, the Caterpillar papered its file by suddenly characterizing those concerns as having been egregious. Quote, Heather had several altercations with different employees during the first 30 days of employment. There'd never been any mention of altercations before, just needing to learn to work with employees of other personality types. She was, quote, very uncooperative and disruptive to the cohesiveness of the team. None of these issues having been raised with that level of severity to her before to make her think that this was anything more than part of just her ongoing development as an employee. She raised concerns about her 30-day performance review on September 21st of that year, which was a Thursday. She did not work over the weekend, as I recall. And then by Monday, she was terminated before she'd ever had a chance to really respond to the concerns the Caterpillar had discussed with her on September 21st. If Caterpillar had done so, we might very well have difficulty establishing pretext. But under those circumstances, and particularly given this court's added rigor in applying the de novo standard in cases such as these, we believe that a reasonable jury could easily infer pretext from that evidence, in which case it could obviously find in Ms. Austin's favor, and that being the case, the grant of summary judgment as to that count of her complaint was improper, and we ask this court to reverse it and to remand for trial on the merits on that. The second issue on this appeal is whether Caterpillar, although it had an on-paper anti-discrimination policy that its managerial employees were aware of, whether in Ms. Austin's case it took reasonable efforts to implement that policy. I think the best place to start for looking at that time frame was, again, with her September 18th 30-day performance review. It kind of coached Ms. Austin on those problems. She felt that a lot of the concerns that had been raised, she thought were fellow employees' retaliation for her previous protected expressions about racial animus, and so she was concerned about that. She spoke with Caterpillar management on September 21st. From the record, it appears the Caterpillar's only investigation into those complaints was to talk to the exact same employees who had been raising concerns about her performance before, not to look any further than that, and then immediately at the start of the next work week, before she'd had any meaningful opportunity to make her performance conform to whatever Caterpillar had expressed its concerns to be, it let her go that day before she ever had a chance to respond to those concerns. We believe that's analogous to the Fifth Circuit's decision in Deffenbaugh Williams v. Walmart stores that we discussed in both our principal brief and our reply brief. In that case, a Walmart employee had been subjected to a couple of pretty minor disciplinary actions for an alleged violation of a store rule and then suddenly terminated for pretextual reasons after that. And there, the Fifth Circuit even specifically acknowledged that they did not consider the evidence to be overwhelming in that case, favoring an award of punitive damages, but it was sufficient for a reasonable jury to draw that inference, and so the court didn't find that it was within its purview to reverse that decision as a matter of law. In that case, about a month after that employee's protected expression, she was fired for pretextual reasons. For the reasons that I've discussed, we believe that's what happened here. And I see that I'm running into my rebuttal time, so if there are no further questions, I'll yield the floor to opposing counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Turner. We'll hear now from Mr. Turner.
I may please the court. Your Honor, this is a relatively straightforward Title VII case in which the facts are really not in material dispute. Indeed, critically, the plaintiff in this case, Heather Austin, did not dispute the material facts laid out by Caterpillar in its motion for summary judgment supporting its decision to terminate her employment during her observation period, as they would be required to do if they were putting them into dispute for purposes of summary judgment under the Northern District of Indiana Local Rule 56.1. Now, those facts, again, are undisputed and are essentially that we have an employee, Heather Austin, who worked for Caterpillar for somewhere less than 45 days. She was engaged in a team activity of stocking parts to an assembly line. Again, that was a job that was owned by a team of employees. The importance of the team concept was not unknown to Ms. Austin, as it was stressed in the employee guide that she received on her first day of employment. It was noted as one of the critical success factors for the Lafayette engine plant that she worked in. In her 30-day performance evaluation, teamwork was one of the categories that was noted. This was the way that they did business in that job. After she received her evaluation from Becky Edmond, her direct supervisor, she wasn't happy with it, and that's understandable because the marks that she received in that evaluation were certainly not up to par. So she decided to elevate her dissatisfaction with her performance review and also her dissatisfaction with her relationship with her team members, an issue that she had raised with Ms. Edmond on the second day of her employment prior to any complaints being made about any untoward or offensive comments being made by other employees. She decided to escalate those dissatisfactions to the second shift general supervisor, a man named Harry Joyce. Mr. Joyce agreed to investigate her concerns, as she suggested, and the way that he investigated her concerns was to go out and talk to four of her team members who he was acquainted with. What he learned from those team members was that it was not the team members' issue, that it was in fact Heather Austin's issue, that she was uncooperative, that she was not working in the spirit of a team, and a specific example was given of when she had finished her particular stocking area early, she did not float over as team members were required to do to help other team members who had not yet finished their duties. Based on that, he went to see Becky Edmond, looked at the paperwork in her file, found that there were numerous instances in which she had not performed her job adequately. Again, none of these issues are in dispute, as Ms. Austin did not choose to dispute them in a response to the summary judgment motion. Based on these issues, the poor job performance, which was evident from the documentation in her relatively short period of employment, and also based on what Mr. Joyce had learned from her team members, again, comments which are not in dispute, nor is there any suggestion that those comments were somehow tainted by her team members, Joyce decided to dismiss Ms. Austin during her observation period as an employee who was not meeting the standard that they would expect for an employee at that point. Now, Austin bases her retaliation claim roughly on the timing issue, but again, the timing issue is one of her own making. She went to Harry Joyce on September 21st and complained about the way she was getting along with her team, not specifically about a comment made by one employee, but about the way she was being treated generally in her team. And in Mr. Joyce's investigation, he determined that his team was not the problem, but again, that Ms. Austin was the problem. This is particularly, the issue of timing is particularly evident here, where there was some discussion by Ms. Austin's counsel about whether or not her performance could be deemed satisfactory based on her own testimony. Well, what we have, again, is a 45-day employee. We don't have an employee with a 10-year track record of meeting the employment standard. We have one who's been there for a very short time. We also have an employee who has chosen not to dispute the issues with her employment that were set forth in the summary judgment motion, that there were numerous emails sent about understocking and overstocking problems, that her team members came forward on several occasions to Ms. Edmond and complained about her lack of cooperativeness, that when Mr. Joyce went out to investigate how she was doing with her team, four members said, she's not helping us out. And that was the basis that he made his decision. The second issue that they raised is that somehow the issue of not working well in a team or failing to stock her line appropriately is somehow an unusual or novel reason for terminating someone. Well, it's certainly not a novel or unusual reason for terminating someone whose primary job duty is to properly stock a line when there are numerous instances in their first 45 days of employment that they're not properly stocking the line. Further, again, the teamwork is not some sort of nebulous thing that was pulled out of thin air to justify Ms. Austin's termination. It was set forth very clearly that this was the way work was expected to be done at Caterpillar. And again, her co-team team members came to her supervisors and complained about her lack of cooperativeness. None of that is disputed in the record. She points again to the testimony by two non-supervisory employees who did not work on the same shift as she did, as stating that they, well, yes, understocking occurred, overstocking occurred. There's no testimony in the record that it occurred at the same rate that it occurred with Ms. Austin. There's no testimony that it occurred during a probationary period. In short, no testimony that there is some other similarly situated employee out there with a performance profile that matches in significant ways or in substantial or material ways Ms. Austin's performance profile, who never made complaints about offensive racial comments but were retained by Caterpillar. There's nothing in the record that suggests that. So she's failed to lay out a sufficient prima facie case under the Stone standard, which says you must show that you're working satisfactorily, and also some similarly situated person who's been treated more favorably than you and who is not engaged in the protected activity. So we don't have a prima facie case, and we don't have any evidence of pretext. Again, the record is devoid of any evidence that Mr. Joyce did not, in fact, act on the information that he received from the four team members and based on his review of the paperwork. There's nothing to suggest that that was an insufficient reason to terminate someone during their probationary employee or that it was somehow out of the norm. So on that ground, the magistrate judge was perfectly correct in granting summary judgment under the claim. As to the remaining issue, quite frankly, I'm not certain that we have an issue at this point. The punitive damage issue was never reached by the lower court in this case, nor was there any reason for them to reach it. I wouldn't assume that this court would want to reach that issue before the district court had first addressed it. Very briefly, in case the court's interested in it, I don't want to repeat what we've said in our brief already, but the Kolstad decision from the Supreme Court laid out the fact that punitive damages are not to be issued against an employer where that employer is engaged in good faith efforts to comply with Title VII. In essence, when you boil down the plaintiff's argument in this case, it is that if the employer is somehow not completely successful in eliminating all discrimination in the workforce, that it somehow fails to meet that Kolstad test. I think that would, in essence, eviscerate the Kolstad test. In this case, there is evidence that the supervisors at issue both received extensive training on Caterpillar's policy of non-harassment and on its non-retaliation policy. And there's no evidence to suggest that that was not taken seriously by the corporation or somehow disregarded at the higher reaches of the corporation. Therefore, in the event the district court was to look at this issue, we believe they would be appropriate in finding that punitive damages should not go to a jury in a case such as this. There are no other questions from the panel. I'll thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Turner.
Much of Caterpillar's argument about the sufficiency of the record on summary judgment centers on Local Rule 56.1. There may have been a technical, formal violation of 56.1, and that I don't believe that in our materials to the trial court that we specifically set out in enumerated paragraphs exactly what we contested. But we did certainly reach that in the body of our brief. The district court certainly had discretion to overlook a minor technical violation of local rule, and it appears to have done so because it addressed our arguments in that regard, addressed the portions of the record that we designated in that regard, specifically those two depositions I discussed earlier, at about pages 12 to 14 of its order, which are pages 13 to 15 in the appellant's appendix. That being the case, the trial court was certainly within its discretion to overlook that technical violation and address according to the record that we had designated in the body of the brief. We have never alleged that teamwork is an invented criterion. We're alleging that it apparently had not considered those criteria to be sufficient to justify termination in the past based upon those two depositions. There's a reasonable inference from that from which the jury could conclude that since it hadn't happened in 38 years of collective experience before that, that reason probably was insufficient without the kind of padding that they did when they papered Ms. Austin's file on September 25th. We don't need to try our case on summary judgment. We believe there are reasonable inferences from the record that we did present to support a reasonable jury in finding in favor of Ms. Austin, so we ask for a remand on the merits. I see my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pat. Our thanks to both counsel, and the case will be taken under advisement.